Please turn with me, if you will, to the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 9. One of the most difficult things in life for all of us is to take a step back and to take an honest look at ourselves. And maybe even when we do that, maybe the next step is even tougher, to be willing to be open enough to admit that we have any problems that we need to address. And this is what this passage is dealing with, just that sense of stepping back a bit and just beginning to look at ourselves, understand where we are, understand what God desires of us. What's fascinating, we are so affected so many times by what happens in the world, and some of the stuff has crept in here. Years ago, for years I coached Little League, and I was coaching soccer that year, and we came in about third or fourth, whatever the last place was. And the, you know, when we finished the year off, some dear mother feeling badly for these poor kids, okay, they didn't get the trophy for coming in number one, see. So she decided we need to buy a trophy for all the team because although we didn't win anything, we were winners anyhow just because we participated. You know the problem with that is? That's coming to the church. And somehow you see for us, we somehow think we can be winners just because we participate. It has created an unbelievable mediocrity in the church and in Christianity that says, you know what, just because you participate, you're a winner. And if there's anything Paul says in this passage, he says, not a chance. Fact of the matter is, he says, I so buffet my body because I'm afraid lest when I have preached to others, I myself should find myself disqualified. And that's the Apostle Paul, not some lesser individual. So as we come to this passage, it is significant because he first of all, in chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, takes a cultural thing, the races that he had watched run. And by the way, Corinth is on an isthmus, if you will, that is joining the major part of Greece above with the lower part. And at that isthmus there, like you have the isthmus of Panama, so you had the isthmus of Corinth, and it was right there. And because it was so centrally located, they used to gather annually for the Isthmian Games. And is that what he's alluding as he takes this cultural picture and draws a picture of how we are to see ourselves? All participate in the race. Only one wins. Now, it is significant because he does that from a cultural point of view. Now, he refers to something else in chapter 10, verse 1 to 13. He says, let me leave culture. I want to go to the Bible. Let me not take a cultural picture. Let me just take biblical pictures for you. And let me draw one picture after another and begin to show you something so clearly painted through the pages of history. All may participate. All do not win. Now, it's interesting, as you look at this, I think just the way we are with so many things years ago, being a bit involved in some of the marathons, and we'd when I'd done the LA and then the Boston, I had applied for the New York, but accepted, and then what happened, ran out of money, so there was no way to go back there, but watching it. 20,000 people start off at the beginning, and then there's a division at a bridge where it begins to sort of slow it down. If you're the fast ones and get there first, you don't get slowed down by the bridge. But you know, by the time you come to the end, people can say, well, we're all winners. See, everybody who finished is a winner. Well, that's true. Oh, you know, I made it 2 miles. Hey, just the fact I participated, I'm a winner. Why not? I went and watched it. See, just the fact that I said and watched it, at least I'm a winner. See, I did something. See, I didn't just sit home at TV and click the thing on. See, years ago there was a marathon, and it had a fellow by the name of Jim Peters who was an outstanding runner, and he came into the Coliseum where they were running at 2 minutes ahead of the then-known world record. After running 26 miles, he was 600 yards short of the end, and nobody near the stadium, and the man collapsed. The next day, people clamored, give him something. I mean, goodness, 2 minutes ahead of the then-known world record as he comes to the stadium, and you give him nothing? That's right, friends. You see, you don't cross the finish line. You simply what? Simply don't win. See, as you look at this business, it's interesting as we come to this passage because the emphasis, by the way, is not on what kind of ministry we have. We talk about winners, and so many times as we assess winning, it's sort of like, what kind of ministry do you have? What have you accomplished? It's not at all what it is. It has nothing to do with what you're doing. It has to do with how we live. We can live as believers and be winners. We can live as believers and be losers. And I got to tell you, the majority will not win. They don't. Look at the passage with me, because in 9:24 to 27, Paul is dealing with this issue. And actually in 9:19 and following, Paul is dealing with this issue. And as he does so, he brings to us something very, very clear. As he points out to us some very salient truths that are here and principles that are here. And I want to start, though, with the one principle we talked about last week. There is a foundational principle upon which all principles are founded. And we need to keep coming back to this over and over again. The principle upon which all principles are founded is that we are not to go beyond that which stands written eternally in the pages of Scripture. That is the foundational principle on which all principles stand. We are not to go beyond that which stands written. Now, it is in light of that, and on the base of that, he then establishes, on the base of Scripture, these principles. And it's interesting because the issue is of winning, but he does two things here. He says, I want to win in two ways. And we start in verse 19, if you will, of chapter 9. And he says, you know, I have freedom, and he's built this freedom all the way in 9, 1 to 18. In fact, see in 9, 1, he says, am I not free? So in chapter 9, verse 19, he says, though I am free. So he begins immediately by claiming the fact he's free. He is free. You understand today? You're free. You just don't ever forget that. We're free. You're free. I'm free. Don't ever be brought again under the yoke of bondage. You're free. And you and I are free today, fully free, to decide to do that which we decide to do. We're free. And so he starts out with this freedom. But, he says, verse 19, I have made myself a slave to all. Why? That I might win, see? And in verses 19 to 23, what he's trying to do is win souls. He says, in fact, in verse 20, I want to win Jews. In verse 20, the latter part, I want to win those who are under the law. In verse 21, I want to win those who are without law. All the way through this passage, he says in verse 22, to the weak I become weak, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men, that by all means I might save some. You know what? We have freedom. But you see, if we want to win, in this case, it's not winning for ourselves, it's winning for the kingdom. We want to win souls. I'm amazed how many people, quote unquote, want to win souls, and they start compromising because they think it's a greater way to win souls. In this passage, you win souls by what? Disciplining yourself and restricting yourself from exercising many of the freedoms that are totally yours to exercise. Because your desire is that you want to win. You want to win souls. And you're willing to sacrifice the freedoms you have in order that you might see people won to Jesus Christ. So he says, first of all, I want to win souls, and I'm willing to sacrifice my freedom, 19 to 23, to win souls. But I don't only want to win souls. In 24 to 27, I want to win the approval of God. And I want to, verse 24, I want to run the last part of verse 24. I want to run in such a way that I can win. Everyone, verse 25, who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. And they do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way, not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. I buffet my body. And by the way, it's not buffet my body either. I buffet my body And I make it my slave, lest possibly after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. And that statement that comes in the first part of verse 24 is so crucial. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only what? One receives the prize. That is the principle upon which everything he's going to say in 10:1 to 13 rests. All run, only one gets a prize. All run, only one gets a prize. This is not, the Bible is not, if you will, some standard for mediocrity that says just because you're running the race, you're a winner. No. It's how you run in a race that makes you the winner. And it has not to do with what we do. It has to do with how we live. And I say this to you today because I am anxious that in the process of my preaching to others, I might not find myself disqualified in this race. I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose. I don't only want to see souls won. I want to stand before God one day and know that not only did I win souls, but I won His approval. And I have Him say to me, well done. And you know what? You didn't just run 26 miles. You finished the last 600 yards. I don't want to lose. I flat out don't want to lose. I want to win. And I want somehow to look at this passage and say to God, God, what will it take for me to win? So look with me, if you will, at chapter 10, verses 1 to 13, because really what is at issue here? As one has well said, perhaps too many contemporary Christians have lost sight of their eschatological goal or are running aimlessly if they are in the contest at all. Some of us have lost sight of the eschatological goal. We are not eschatological people. We're very earthbound people. We've lost sight of the goal. We run aimlessly. And then it says, but the probability is that there are some people who think they're running and they're not even in the contest at all. Now look at the passage with me, if you will, because the argument is in two parts, in 10:1 and following. In verses 1 to 5, he draws to us a picture from the Old Testament. He goes back to Israel. And then he makes the application in verses 6 through 11, and then he draws his conclusion in verses 12 to 13. Now, it is interesting as you begin this part of the passage, notice with me the statement in verse 1, 4. And the minute you see this 4 in here, it's going to go pick up on the previous passage that said, all compete, only one receives the prize. And then he comes to this passage that I don't want you to be unaware, brethren. I don't want you to be ignorant. Why? They're our fathers. Now, just stop with this. Our fathers. And you say, hold it. I am not Jewish. They're our fathers. So hold it. They're Israelitish people. They're our fathers. Do you understand this? He says, go back and understand the spiritual heritage we have, and we are not. We are not Israel. Okay, understand that. But spiritually, these are our fathers. Unless we remove ourselves from these Old Testament saints and say, you know what, they're just nice stories. I learned them in Sunday school. I even taught them in Sunday school. God says it's not enough. Do you understand? Those were our spiritual fathers. And they have an amazing story to tell us. Look as he goes down to this passage, because verse 11 is going to tell us what the whole issue. These things, well, let's read verse 6 and then verse 11. These things, okay, that our fathers did happened as examples for us. Or look back down to verse 11. Now these things happen to them again as examples. Let's stop and understand that the reason for studying Old Testament stories, and we ought to study them more, they're not just nice stories. They're not just fun stories. They're not just interesting stories. These stories were written because God wanted to teach us a lesson. And somehow we need to go back and look at these stories as he will do in this passage, and we need to understand what God is trying to say to you and God is trying to say to me. All compete. All do not win. If you look at verse 11 carefully with me just for a while, he starts out with these things, and the these things of verse 11 are the things we're going to look at in verses 1 to 10. It's all of those things that are there. Then he says, these things happened to them, and there's an emphasis here on this, on the fact that it happened to the people of Israel. And it's interesting because it is an imperfect tense which suggests it happened time after time after time after time. That's why he's going to pick up story after story after story. Why? Because it didn't just happen once. When you read it, it sounds like this just happened to Israel. One time they happened to fall this way. No, God says it happened time and time and time again. And you know what? Just to stop for a while, understand, in the church of Jesus Christ, it happens time and time and time and time again. God says these things were continuously happening time and time again. Notice, and they were written, though, for our instruction, so that you and I would have instruction. Notice, written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Now, you know what? There have been a whole bunch of ages. You go back and you can look at the various ages that have happened, starting from the very beginning with Adam and Eve, and look at all of these ages, okay? You know what? We are beneficiaries of all of those stories, starting from Genesis 1 all the way through. And you know what? We have all kinds of things that were given to us throughout all of those ages. And now it comes to this point. And I got to tell you what, we have a lot to be responsible for, because God has given us an account throughout all of these ages. And it has now come to this point in our history. And God says, you are the one unto whom the ends of these ages have come. How much more responsible I am and you are today than they were back then, because we know a lot more than they did. We have an awful lot more to go on. We have a lot more examples to follow. We have a lot more admonitions to receive from God than ever they did. Now he says, the written for our instruction, unto whom the end of the ages have come. Now what are these things? And go back with me to these examples that are given to us, and they're amazing examples. But I want you to see the overriding truth. Don't miss it. Verse 2. Let me go back to 9:24. Read this 9:24. Do you not know that those who run in a race, what? All run, yes? Okay. But notice, but only one receives the prize. Yes? Go with me to chapter 10. Notice this. I start in verse 1 of chapter 10. All our fathers were under the cloud, right? All passed through the sea. All were baptized. Verse 3, all ate the same spiritual food. Verse 4, all drank the same spiritual drink. You get the point? Something about all. Verse 5. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Let me ask you a question. All competed in the prize. 2 to 2.5 million people. I want to ask you, how many people above 20 years of age finally won the prize? How many? 2. 2.5 million people competed, and my friend, only 2 above 20 walked into the land of promise. Only 2. Now, just think about this for a while. That was written for your example and mine. All compete. Only 2 win. All compete. Only 2 win. All compete. Only 2 win. That's an amazing statement. A lot of people, my friend, are competing. Not a whole bunch are going to win. And I want to win. Don't know about you, but I do. Look at the passage. I start out with the beginning because he takes these illustrations for us, and he makes these statements, several illustrations. Notice, first of all, he says, all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses. Now, it isn't baptism like we know baptism, and don't you dare handle the passage this way, because he can do it, I can't do it, nor can you. But he's giving us a picture. All of them were identified. All identified with walking under the cloud, all identified with passing through the sea. And again, there is water involved in here, so he draws this picture over to the fact that we have been saved and we've been baptized and we passed through the experience of baptism. And so you can say, well, how many have been baptized today? And we say, oh, we've been baptized. All of us have been baptized, see? He says, my friend, even if I took a number this morning, maybe all of us have not been through water baptism. It's good if we do. We ought to. But you know what? There wasn't one of them who missed that experience. All of them walked under the cloud. There's not one of them who didn't. Every one of them passed through the Red Sea. Not one of them who didn't. Not one who didn't. So they start with this experience, unique experience, because they all participated together in what he likens to our baptism. And he says there wasn't a single soul of all of Israel who missed the experience of walking through the Red Sea and participating in that act which he likens to the act of baptism. Everyone did it. No one missed. My friend, if you didn't go through the Red Sea, you were still in Egypt, okay? Notice the next, okay? They all did this, every single one. Notice the next part. They not only all were baptized, notice something else. They all participated in a spiritual supper. I have to call this a spiritual supper. I know you don't understand what suppers are. Some of us understand what suppers are. We have breakfast, dinner, and supper. You don't have suppers here. You have breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's all right. Some of us understand what suppers are. This was a supper, okay? They all ate the spiritual supper. Now, by the way, just like the physical experience of walking through the Red Sea and walking under the cloud, so it was a very physical experience of eating spiritual food and spiritual drink. Now, it was actual physical food. It was different food. It was heaven food. And the day came, you see, when they grumbled to God, and God gave them quail one night, and the next morning then God gave them manna, and manna lasted for all of those years till they walked into the promised land. But this was food from heaven, as truly as there ever was heavenly food. This was heavenly food. And an amazing truth. God says, you know what? You gather up each day just what you need. Don't you gather up extra. Because I provide daily. And he says, this is what I want you to do. The first day, some people decide, well, we better get some extra. We might run out. It molded up and God got angry. God said, I told you just what you needed. So then God said, come the sixth day, God says, all right, now tomorrow you're not supposed to gather. So God, tell you what, gather up double. And they say, well, God, you know what? We had a problem before because some people tried gathering too much. So some of them decided they wouldn't gather extra. And the next day they went out there and there was none on the ground. And got angry again. Why in the world don't you listen to me? Just enough. I'll take care. And for 40 years, every day it was there. Every day it was there. And then you imagine the water. I don't think we can imagine. We talk about it. We don't even comprehend it. You're in the middle of a desert, okay? You're in the middle of a desert. There is absolutely no water. There are not even any trees around. And here are 2 to 2.5 million people, and they're all thirsty, and they need water. And all of a sudden, out of a rock, mind you, a real rock. Out of a rock comes enough water to provide for 2 to 2.5 million people. Do you believe he could still do that? Do you really believe that he could still do that? I hope so. 2.5 million people watched food come out of heaven every day and watched water come out of a rock in the middle of a desert, and there's no way to explain that phenomenon aside from the fact that God miraculously provided supernaturally for them. And you know what? Every single one of them participated. Everybody. What a blessing. You know, people say, I wish I'd been there when Jesus walked the earth, or wish I'd been there when I'd see something like this. My friend, they were there, and they all participated in watching God do such a supernatural thing of such a nature that you and I have never seen the kind before in our life. Physically watch the food every day, physically watch the water, every provision that they needed, not only here, but it says it continued to fall. And so they all participated in drinking the spiritual drink and eating the spiritual food. Notice something else. They all participated in something else. They were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Jesus Christ. Now, nowhere else is this taught, but isn't that amazing truth? He says that rock was something from which they were continually drinking because it was a spiritual one. It was Jesus Christ himself. You think the water just came from the rock? The water came from Jesus Christ. He was there. Jesus walked every step of the way through the wilderness, a wilderness that should never have wandered through. And my friend, you and I wander through wildernesses we should never wander through. But I got to tell you, even when you wander through the wilderness, he is still there with you. And he walked with them for 40 years through a wilderness that was a result of disobedience, and he never left them. They were all experiencing his presence for 40 years. Might I remind you, he never leaves you. No matter how deep the waters, no matter how dry the desert, no matter how hungry you become, he is always there. So they experienced this. So number one, they all participated in true baptism. They all participated in partaking of the spiritual food. They all participated in the reality of the presence of Christ. They all participated in the provision of Christ. You look in this passage, you see he was with them and they drank from the spiritual rock which followed them. And you know the story, not once during all of those years of 40 years did their clothes wear out. God kept their clothes, their shoes, and all the wandering, God kept their shoes from wearing out. For 40 years he provided for them, and every single one of them experienced the evidence of his presence and his blessing. Everybody did. Nobody left out. It wasn't as if someone could say, you know, they got to see it. I never did. No, everybody did. Everybody did. All. Now comes this startling truth of verse 5. Verses 1 to 4 is one continuous sentence in the Greek, and now comes this contrast in verse 5. Nevertheless, with most of them, i.e. everybody but two, God was not well pleased. For why? For, he says, they were laid low in the wilderness. You know what? Literally, they were strewn out through the wilderness. Every last one of them, except for two, all participated in the blessing. The startling truth was all but two were left in the desert dead. Now you can figure out the figures. We're not told exactly. Say that there were 2 to 2.5 million people left. Who left Egypt. Figure out how many of those were 20 and above. Let's say it was even a million. All but two of them were left lying in the desert. 40 years. Every one of them died but two. Every one but two. Now, he says, I want to apply this to you because I want to take you back to Israel. And I want to give you a specific example so you understand exactly what I have to say. So now let me give you some sobering applications to your life. Verse 6, now, these things that I've just recounted to you, they happened as examples to us that we should not crave evil things as they also craved. By the way, the word that we should not crave evil things, it's got, let me tell some of you for free and the rest you can do it. It's got this taste at the end, okay? It's like ER in English, okay? John the Baptizer. Okay, this is what he continuously did. He baptized people. That's what's at the end of this. We are lusterers, if you will. We are lusterers. It isn't just that we happen to lust. He says, you know what, I'm telling you this because as an example to those of us who are lusterers, we are characterized by lust. We're characterized by satisfying our own pleasures. We're characterized by these things. This is what characterizes our way of life. We're lusterers. Now he says, I write these things to you. He said, and to go back to the verse, these things are written examples that we should not be lusterers as they also lusted, if you will. Now he said, let me give you some illustrations. First of all, the first illustration is sinful pleasure. It starts out in verse 7, and do not be idolaters, some of them were. As is written, the people sat down to eat and play and stood, sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Now, the first example, everybody had these spiritual blessings, okay? Everybody did. And yet, you know what those people did? And by the way, you would think that maybe, because the emphasis of the passage is they made this golden calf, right? And you'd think that the emphasis of this passage is they built the golden calf and they worshiped the golden calf, but that's not what he draws up as an emphasis. Because there were a lot of people when they built this golden calf. Understand, 2.5 million people. There are a lot of people when they built this golden calf said, I'm not going to bow down to that thing. And they didn't. Oh, they built it. Or Aaron did. Or Aaron said, actually, they gave this gold, and you know what? It turned out into this thing, see? No, it didn't do anything. It just turned out into this golden calf. Uh-huh. So Aaron builds this golden calf. Some people bow down to worship that. He says, this is Yahweh that brought you out of the land of Egypt, this golden calf. A lot of people, they wouldn't worship it, but you know what they did? When they started to party and play, they joined in with that. You know what bothered him about the church at Corinth and needs to bother us about us today? We eat and drink, and we party. Or you may define it differently and say, well, I don't party like the world does. But you know what bothers him about the church at Corinth and what bothered him about the people back then? Maybe they didn't participate in the evil worship, but they did participate in the stuff that sucked them into the ways of the society around them. You see, for Corinth, it's not bad that you eat. I mean, it's not an actual sin that you eat meat offered to idols. That's not a sin in and of itself. It's not even a sin if you go to a banquet where this is served. That's not a sin in and of itself. Understand that, see? He's just dealt with this in chapters 8 and 9. He says, what's sinful is that so many of you are starting to participate with people of the world, and now you're starting to be like those people of the world, and you're starting to eat and to drink and to play just like they do. So God says, that's the first thing. And I think the caution as I read this from my own heart is just to be careful, because for so many of us, we don't do just like the world, but we're sucked into a lot of the things that the world is sucked into. We are. Notice something else. Verse 8. Second thing is immorality. Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. We'll come back to this. Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did. Now, it's interesting, by the way, 23,000 fell in one day. What happened is they started looking around them, and we'll read this story in just a little while. And they saw these women that looked very attractive, and then they weren't godly women, but they thought, boy, you know what, they're sure nice-looking women. And so therefore, they decided, let's marry them, and God got so angry, he killed 23,000 in one day and 24,000 overall. You say we don't do that? Oh my, do we do it. Again, I'll just say, forget the laity of the church. Just take the pastors of the churches of America today. They're lusting, my friend. They're fornicating. And then they're going back in the pulpit again. And if the pastors are doing it, I guarantee you the people are doing it. The immorality is there, the compromise, not only in the actions, but compromise in morality, till pretty soon, you see, we get into this business, and all of a sudden, you see, we begin to find ourselves in a place that just like they, we begin to become immoral and to compromise on areas that have to do with our morality and our relationship sexually with partners that God has given to us. And I remind you of that passage of Malachi. It was such an eye-opening statement to me. I knew the passage well, that God says, you're leaving the wife of your youth. And then he talked about the one whom he witnessed the marrying. And that was an amazing thought to me. Although I said it as service after service, never became so. I didn't realize it so clearly. God says, I witnessed your marriage. I listened to the vows. And I listened to what you said to your wife, and I listened to what your wife said to you, and now you go out and you violate those vows that you made in my presence because I witnessed them. And you know, when you hear the wedding from now on in the witness, you see, of God and of this solemn assembly, understand that God is witnessing the vow. And if it is true that the average rate of divorce among pastors is almost as high as the average national figure, you got to know something. We got some major problems in compromising morality. Notice. Morals, as some of them did. Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. And we'll come to this account in a while, but they tested God. By the way, if you come tonight, you're going to find where God says, come test me. There are some ways God wants you to test him, but only when he invites, not when you decide to. They tested God. And the issue, of course, at that point was when they were not happy with Moses' leadership. And they started making comments against Moses. And God says, when you do that, you're making comments against me because I put him there. God says, you tested me. By the way, what's the testing? And we'll come back to this testing in a while. You know what the testing is? I want to talk about this just for a bit this morning before we conclude. You know what the testing is? We're testing God. Testing in what way, you say? Do you believe, let me ask you a question, do you believe that God has the power to judge sin? Do you believe that? I mean, I'm just serious. Do you believe that God has the power to judge sin? Yes or no? Now my question, and this is the real question. Do you believe that God has the will to judge sin? And just think about that for a while. He did it to Ananias and Sapphira, didn't he? We're going to give us examples here. Every one of these examples. The testing is not the testing of the power of God to judge. The testing is the testing of the purpose of God to judge. Does God will to judge? And many of us are not so sure that God wills to judge. We have no doubt that God has the ability to do it, but we question the fact of God, whether God has the will to do it. Let me come back to that just quickly. Go to the next one. Verse 10. Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. So you find these things that they did. They were rebelliously discontent. And so we start with the first part. They began to compromise in sinful pleasure. They began to get involved in morality. They tested the Lord with regard to the one he placed in leadership. They began to grumble. And you know, it's amazing, the grumbling. I've been reading through Exodus and amazing. They leave the land of Egypt and God delivers them out of there. They come to the Red Sea and they begin to grumble. And God does it on purpose, see? I mean, he could have told them. You say, God, why didn't you at least tell me? Then you see, I could have been prepared. You're sitting here in the Red Sea in front, mountains on either side, the Egyptian army behind. You have no army. And you stand there and say, there's no way out of here. And what does God do? Supernaturally opens the gates and lets them walk through on dry land between the walls of water on either side. And you say, well, God, if you told us ahead of time, we'd have been prepared for this. No, God says, you didn't believe me and you grumbled because you're afraid of what I do to you. They leave there. They come to some water and they're so excited. We finally find water and they get to this water and the water's bitter. Do you not think that God made it that way? And they began to grumble again. So all God says is toss this piece of wood in there. And you know what happens? The water becomes sweet again. He tested them and they grumbled again. Then he takes them a little further and they get the place and say, we don't have any food. So he sends his quail, and I mean, they get so stuffed that night. And then the next day he starts giving them manna for 40 years. Every time they grumble. Instead of trust. Now, just quickly, the testing. Go back with me for just a quick trip. And back of the Old Testament, Exodus chapter 32, let's start there. And then let's move to Numbers quickly. Exodus 32, Genesis, Exodus, the second book, not difficult to find. Exodus chapter 32. Notice what's going to happen here. They make this is the first example we have in verse 7 where they did this. They rose up to party. And verse 25, notice what happens, Exodus 32:25, when the Lord saw the people were out of control, and this is where it is. Notice what he said to them, for Aaron had let them get out of control to be a derision among their enemies. Then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. And he said to them, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put a sword upon his thigh and go back and forth from gate to gate in the camp and kill every man his brother, every man his friend, every man his neighbor. So the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. My friend, does God have the power to judge? Yes. Does he have the purpose to judge? Yes. Go with me over a few books to your right to the book of Numbers chapter 25. Numbers chapter 25. We're going to start in verses 1 to 9. We won't read all, but you see what happened. They tried to curse Israel. They couldn't curse Israel. God wouldn't let Balaam do it. And then what happens is Balaam says, I have a good idea. So this is what they did. Verse 6, behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianitish woman, because they started to look at these women and think, boy, these women look pretty nice. So they bring one of these relatives of a Midianite woman, the sight of Moses and the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they're weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from the midst of the congregation, took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked, and those who died by the plague were 24,000. Paul tells us 23,000 died in one day, and by the time the plague was finished, 24,000 total people died. I ask you, does God have the power to judge sin? Yes. Does God have the purpose or the will to do so? And the answer is what? Yes. Go back with me quickly, if you will. Again, to the next illustration from verse 9. It's in chapter 21 of Numbers. Chapter 21, verses 4 to 9. I'll start in verse 5. The people said, spoke against God and against Moses. Now, as Moses are talking against, but when you talk against Moses, you're talking against God. He said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food, no water, and we loathe this miserable food. See? Be careful what you complain about that God gives you. Because the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people. They bit the people so that many of the people of Israel died. And so the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned because we've spoken against the Lord. And you intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. I ask you again, does God have the power to judge sin? And the answer is yes. The question is, does God have the purpose to judge sin? And the answer is also yes. 3,000 people died. First illustration, verse 7 of 1 Corinthians 10. Verse 8, 24,000 people died, 23 in one day alone. In this case, many died. Go back with me, if you will, just a few chapters. Again, to the fourth illustration. Go to Numbers 16. We'll see this on our way to Numbers 14. Numbers 16, verses 41 to 49. Korah had risen up against Moses in rebellion. And God judged and killed them. What I really want you to look at is what happened is there was a plague because the people said, why in the world have you done this? They said it to Moses when God judged. And look at verse 49. God sent a plague. And verse 49, those who died by the plague were 14,700. Does God have the power to judge sin? He does. Does God have the purpose to judge sin? He does. I'm going to leave the last one only to tell you, go back to Numbers 14. That's the last one. And I'm not going to go there with you today, only to tell you, if you read the passage, you'll find out. You know what happened there? It was when God sent the spies into the land, or after they sent the spies in the land, they came back. And after 40 days of being in the land, 10 of them says, we will not go. Why? Because God provided the provision for them. But you see, they looked at what they had and they said, we can't fight this kind of a war. Therefore, we're not going to go, and because of their lack of faith, God sent a plague and killed the other 10 men, it says in the plague. And then God said to everybody, 20 years and above, you will die in this wilderness. And the common denominator for all of these people in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and throughout all of this, their bodies were strewn through the wilderness because God not only has the power to judge, God has the will and the purpose to do so as well. You say it's just the Old Testament. Oh, no, it's not. Quickly go with me back to 1 Corinthians 10 and then turn with me to chapter 11 just for a moment. They were dishonoring the Lord's Supper. And notice what God says in verse 30 of chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians. For this reason, 1 Corinthians 11:30, for this reason, because of the sin that's taking place in the church of Corinth, many among you are weak and many are sick, and there are a number who are even dead. They're asleep. And if we judged ourselves rightly, we should not be judged. I think today, in fact, we got a letter from one of our missionaries, email, says, you know, somebody out in Africa sinned, and they believe when they watch what's happening in their family that God is judging that sin. And that's what they believe out there in Africa. These people who don't have Bibles like we have Bibles, they don't know the Bible like we know the Bible, but when they see something like this happen, they believe that God not only has the power to judge, God has the will to do so. And the statement in the email is, we believe this, although this is not something believed very strongly in the Western church. That's true. All participated in the blessing. Only two made it. All the rest were strewn throughout the desert. Now, quickly, the final warnings in light of this. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, just notice with me. Two warnings in here, two important warnings. One of them has to do to the self-confident. If you think, I have been baptized and I go to church and I'm a part of the church and God has blessed me, my friend, even if God is providing for your needs and you say, because of this, it must mean I'm walking right with God. It doesn't mean that at all. Understand this. God provided for all of these people through the wilderness and God was still not well pleased with most of them. Just his provision alone does not prove his blessing or his pleasure. Otherwise, the story doesn't make any sense at all that all of them participated in his provision, but only two of them made it. Now notice, if you think you're standing, take heed lest you fall, lest it be first of all, participation with them in verse 7, immorality, verse 8, grumbling against God in verse 10, rebelling against the leadership he's provided in verse 9. Now notice, again, he doesn't want to end on this kind of a note. So he gives us a verse that we know probably better than most verses, but we don't know it in his context. Here is the verse. No temptation has ever overtaken you, but such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond that you are able, but will with the temptation provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. My friend, you know what? The beautiful part of all of this, you want to be a winner? He provides the way. First of all, I got to tell you something. Many of us, when we go through trials, we think, you know, oh, I alone am doing this, and we go through this kind of stuff, and we think, my, nobody else understands what I'm going through, and I suffer stuff like nobody else can identify with. That's not true. Don't let that kind of stuff be a part of your life because it will destroy you. It's the same thing he says in 1 Peter 5. Understand that these kinds of things are being experienced by believers all over the world. You're not alone. You go through a trial, my friend. You're not the first one to have gone through it. That's the first thing. Understand that. And nor are you the only one going through it. Remember a dear sister. She says, I used to share in our group at church about the problems of my marriage, and nobody else would share. And I thought I was the only one having problems. And now she says, this 20 years later, I'm watching their marriages fall apart one after another. And I realized they were struggling just like I was. Don't believe that you're alone. Don't ever sell yourself that bill of goods. My friend, other people struggle with the same thing we're struggling with. That doesn't mean that we need to stay in the struggle. Just understand that, you see, we're not alone in this. But notice the next part, God is faithful. That's a beautiful part of this, the faithfulness of God in the midst of this. And now notice this, the faithfulness of God is manifest in the fact he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. You know what? I can be a winner because God will never subject me to anything that he knows that I cannot by his grace and through his strength overcome. Nothing. What a beautiful truth. I can make it through this. Boy, sometimes it feels like you can't make it through another day like this, but God says, you know, I know you can do it. And why is it, you see, that God so often subjects people to things when he knows he can trust them with this? I tell you this story, and I've told you before, of a dear friend of ours, whose one child, first child was born normal, second child wasn't, and still bearing the results of that as a grown woman now. The last child was born with damage in every part of his brain. He's 30 now, that range, and he's still like a little child, and they will for the rest of their lives take care of him. In fact, the wife flew with this son back to the Midwest a while back, and he so came apart on the plane that the husband got in a car and drove back to bring them home. It's just how it is, and it's going to be all their life this way. They're committed to that. And one day, an aunt from Clovis, a dear farmer's wife, huh? Boy, they seem to know the truth. She's visiting, and she says, Arlene, God must really love you. And Arlene looks at her aunt and says, why in the world would you say that? And he says, to think that he could trust you with so much. God will never bring us to a place with something that we cannot deal with, but will. With the temptation, by the way, it's an article in both cases, so you understand this, will with the temptation provide the way to escape. There is a corresponding way out of every trial that corresponds to the trial that we are going through. God not only allows us to go through the trial or brings us to that trial, God provides with that trial the particular way to escape that is necessary for us to be able to get out of that which we're in. And my friend, whatever you're going through, you're not the first one to have gone through it. And you understand that God is faithful and understands that he has provided before the trial ever came the way for you to walk through that trial. You see the whole point of this. I don't have to lose in this battle of godly living. I can win. But let me tell you something. You have a lot of company with people who have gone through the trials you've gone through, but you're not going to have a lot of company with the people who come out winners on the other side. Believe me. All participate. Very few real winners. You don't believe that? Look at the Church of America today. There are a lot of participants. How many people can you look at who are really making a dent and making a difference, and through their life they're showing that they're different than everybody else, and they're transacting some amazing stuff with God so that they're transformed in their own life and they're transforming the lives of others? The problem, my friend, isn't America today. The problem isn't even the corruption of the politics of America today. The problem isn't even the church in America today. The problem is you and me. We're satisfied with mediocrity. And in the end, my friend, we will not win. Oh, yes, it says in chapter 3, we'll get saved. but such as by fire. We'll just make it, but we'll get there. Just because you participate doesn't make you a winner. Believe me. And I don't want to lose. I do want to win. And I hope you do too. Please bow with me in prayer. Again, our Father, we look at this passage and it's difficult. And we realize that the stories of Israel are fun to read and study, but our Father, when we apply them to our lives, they become so much more convicting. And so I yield myself to you today. And Father, I don't want to lose. I fear lest when I've preached to others, I might find myself disqualified because I'm not willing to pay the price that's necessary to walk in a way that's holy before you. Help me not to think that I won't fall, and thereby to think that I can just walk through life feeling that I will succeed each time. But our Father, I realize that's not the case. But Father, realizing that you will never subject me to anything that you have not enabled me to be able through your word and through your spirit to overcome. To that end, our Father, I pray that you'll enable me to understand the importance of walking in holiness and in victory with you. And we praise you in Jesus' name.